other people in the state of Maine, because they never thought it would happen. And I guess they also began realizing, or began getting upset by the fact that it appeared that a whole lot, if not all, the horses were already out of the barn. And that the Passamaquoddy case had already been decided, and the question of the applicability of the Non-Intercourse Act had been resolved. And so this, they became very upset. The governor and the attorney general became extremely distraught and began doing a number of very strange things. First of all, back in 1972, the governor of the state of Maine and the entire Maine congressional delegation called on the federal government to sue the state of Maine. This is before we obtained the order forcing the government to do it. Called on the federal government to sue the state of Maine, saying that if the Indians had a claim, they were entitled to their day in court, and it should not go by way of the statute of limitations or some technicality. They should have their case tried fully, and if they are entitled to something, they should get it. And in fact, the Maine delegation back in 1972 supported an extension of the statute of limitations to give the Indians more time to convince the government to proceed if the courts wouldn't order the government to proceed. Well, it's hard to tell what made the difference. It may have been that they never thought that we'd succeed back then. It may be that that they couldn't believe it. Or it may just have been a difference in the personalities that were in charge then and the personalities that are in charge now. But this fall, we got a very different kind of phenomenon. Back in October, I guess it was, the governor of our state, after the Maine Municipal Bond Bank suddenly found that it couldn't sell its securities on the national bond market, went down to Washington and expressed his, I'm trying to think of a delicate way to say it, his concern to the congressional delegation. And these four members of the congressional delegation, who all along had steadfastly said that this was a matter for the courts, and that they would not involve themselves in it, and the Congress should not get involved in it, and the law was the law, and we all had to live by the law, suddenly found themselves the following day introducing a proposed joint congressional resolution, which would have put the Congress of the United States on record as telling the courts of the United States that Congress doesn't want any of the courts of the United States to hear these Indians' claim for return of land. Money damages, maybe, but not return of land. That provision never went anywhere. But as soon as this new Congress got together, got started, in fact, the day after the Justice Department announced its intention to proceed with a case for at least 5 million acres, the congressional delegation, at the request of the Maine governor and attorney general, submitted a bill in Congress, which is still sitting there, which would have dealt with the claims of the Maine Indians by retroactively ratifying all of the transactions by which the Indians lost their land. And it's still sitting there. The bill which says that all of the transactions by which the Maine Indians lost their land are hereby ratified. The Indians are perfectly free to proceed in court for any kind of money that they can win. But you tell me how there's any money for them to win if all those transactions are ratified as of the day they took place. Where is there any claim for return of land, or where is there any claim for money damages? Where is there any trespass? I guess what I'm saying to you, and I should add this, that in the remarks that accompanied the bill, and if this is reported, I hope it gets included, Senators Muskie and Senator Hathaway made it clear that they didn't think they didn't intend to entirely take away the claims of the tribe. They were going to take away their right to recover land, and somehow they thought that was okay. But at least in their remarks, they acted as though they thought that bill was not going to totally kill the tribe's claim to seek some monetary damages. When you read the bill, it clearly does, however. And I'm willing to give those two senators the benefit of the doubt. But what I guess I want to say to you and conclude with is... before I do it, I'll just say that what's happened in the meantime is that the chairman of the subcommittee in the House side to which the bill was referred and the chairman of the full committee the Congressman Ranafalio and Mr. Udall, and the chairman of the Senate committee to which it was referred, all have said that they will not hold hearings on it. The reason that they've said that they would not hold hearings is that the president had announced that he was going to appoint a special representative to attempt to work out a solution. And they said that that's the appropriate forum. They expect this matter ultimately to come before the Congress. And when it does, however, they said they would take a very dim view of any of the parties who did not participate in good faith in the proposed negotiations, but they would not hold hearings on that particular legislation. Now, whether or not they will have to change their minds or will change their minds, we don't know, but I can't imagine that they would. The point, I guess, that I want to make, and President Carter has now appointed Justice William Gunter, personal friend of his and a retiring man who's just retired from the Georgia Supreme Court, who strikes us as being an extremely decent human being and who's trying, I think, very hard to come to grips with these issues and understand the problems and to decide the proper way to go. Here's what I want to say to you is that bill is still on file. The prospect of that kind of congressional outrage is still there, that or something different. And the real problem with all this is that if this country deals with the successes which these two tribes have had to date in court, and moreover deals with the prospect of these tribes having future successes in court, by attempting to retroactively rewrite history, or to change the law, or to change the courts, or to change the rules in some way, then the Congress of the United States is going to be sending a very clear signal to everybody in this country, not just minority groups and disaffected people who commit themselves to the judicial process, but to everybody, that that's a waste of time. You know, that this system, you know, what some people say really is true, that this system has got a price. And it might be all right for you to bring an action seeking $10 or $1,000 or even a couple million dollars, but there's a limit to how much justice the system will afford. And just don't ask for too much. Just be sure that you don't ask for too much, even if it's what you're entitled to. And that, I submit to you, is a really frightening prospect, because we all depend on that judicial system. That's the only thing that stands between us and chaos. And the only way that that system works, or the only way that you can expect people to commit themselves to the law and to live within it and work within that system, is that everybody can be sure that it's always going to be there when it comes time for it to pay off. That system, if people abide by it, will also work for them when the time comes. Now, the tribes in Maine have made it abundantly clear that despite their extraordinary legal position, they are not demanding their pound of flesh. They are not demanding that the people who live in Maine in the 10 million acres, in the 2 million acres out of the 10 million acres that makes up their claim area, they're not demanding that those people leave. This is not a grudge match. They are willing to sit down and negotiate in good faith a settlement of these claims, one which will not displace anybody. They're willing to say as a condition at the outset that in negotiated settlement they would not seek removal of anyone. And they're willing to enter into negotiations which could wind up benefiting not just them, but the state of Maine and, I guess, the nation in a more philosophical sense as well. How we come out of this, I think, is going to be very important, not just for these claims, because these claims are going to get forgotten, and they'll be gone. What's really at stake in a larger sense are two things, is the strength of this nation's promises to Indian people, and more fundamentally, the strength of its legal system itself, because it's not the easy cases that test that system. You don't find out anything about the system or about anybody's integrity, or morality or anything else from easy cases. It's the hard cases that put it to the test. And these cases in Maine are about as hard and as unusual as any that comes along. And how they get resolved is going to tell us a whole lot about how healthy our nation is. And we're going to find this out. The verdict's not in yet, but we're going to find it out. Either the tribes must be allowed to litigate their claims for anything that they would be entitled to win. Under the existing rules, without anybody trying to rewrite history, or else there has to be an honorable, bilateral, negotiated settlement out of court. Those are the only two acceptable alternatives. Anything else is going to leave us with a legacy that says that this system doesn't work and that everybody or anybody is a fool and waste their time if they commit themselves to it. Now, I've burned up an extra 15 minutes and I'll quit and we'll deal with questions.
About the paper companies up there, how they feel, what are they doing?
Well, I don't, again, I can tell you what my fantasies are. I do have fantasies about what they're doing, but and not all of them are paranoid. But I can't tell you any, I can't give you any truth, because I don't know. The paper, other than to say the paper companies are laying very, very low. They did not get involved in the Passamaquoddy case. They did not involve themselves in that litigation. We were successful in that litigation, and now they simply are not doing anything on the surface. What they're doing behind the surface, I don't know, although it is rather interesting that we find that the Maine Attorney General, who's always billed himself as a real champion of the people, talking about how terrible it would be if the Indians were allowed to proceed against the paper companies. Yes?
Tom, do you see this for Eastern Indians to pursue this more, to look into their legalities more in the land claim, since a lot of the reservations have been terminated on the East Coast?
Well, I mean, frankly, my own feeling is, and this comes from working in the area, having dealt with many of the tribes in the East over the last 8 years, is that there are a limited number of claims in the East to be brought, and I think that virtually all of them are in court already, or are about to be in court. I don't think that the floodgates are about to open for Eastern Indians generally, or for Indians across the nation. This is a fear that our opponents love to generate. You know, they say, oh, you know, you can't uphold the law because it's going to mean giving back the entire country. Oh, thank you. Most of the land, even in the East, got lost, got taken prior to the revolution. Foreign transactions that were legal. And there are a limited number of claims. I do think that in a larger sense, though, these claims will help Eastern Indians in terms of this business of federal services and eligibility for a federal relationship, because we've knocked down some of the basic assumptions about that and have put tribes in the East in a position where at least they've got a fighting chance to establish a relationship with the government. There must be a genuine Indian community there. There must be something that the government can deal with and relate to. But there is an opportunity now that wasn't there before, and that's a byproduct of these cases, and I think a very important one. Sir?
Would the retroactivity bill be subject, presumably, to court interpretation? My point is, it would be subject to the United States Constitution on whether it's constitutional or not.
You betcha.
And that is part of our system. In fact, that is what the whole system relies on.
You betcha.
So I'm not sure I completely agree with you that our system depends on upholding this right, because if the bill is constitutional, it fits within our system.
Yeah, the problem is even if it were unconstitutional, and even if we could defeat the action on the basis that it's unconstitutional, it ain't exactly a nice thing to do. You put the tribes in a position where, you know, they're very close. We won not just the Passamaquoddy case, by the way, we won a whole series of decisions in southern New England, in smaller claims that we've filed, in which we've knocked out most of the defenses, in which the courts have said that these are remarkably simple cases in terms of what you have to prove. The tribes have gotten to the point where they're very close, and what you're suggesting is that it would just be fine and dandy because it would be technically constitutional for Congress to be able to come up with, you know, an armless 2x4 and take the tribes and hit them, you know, in the face and knock them back 100 yards and then make them spend 5 or 10 years testing the constitutionality of that action. That doesn't jive with my sense of justice. I agree with you that I think it probably would be unconstitutional, although you should know that the Supreme Court has said that Congress technically has the constitutional power to take, under some circumstances, extinguish the aboriginal title of tribes. We feel that's subject to challenge and the open question. But I don't agree with you that that would be a perfectly nice and proper thing to do.
There's a lot of publicity now. You hear a lot about backlash all over the country. Is there any sort of organized movement made or any sort of backlash?
No, not that I. For a while, we were getting some pretty hot statements from our political leaders. There's a great temptation to do that. But I think the people in the state of Maine have given the amount of confusion that's existed, have remained remarkably sane about these issues. It's difficult. You raise a difficult question. Yes.
Joe Chadbury, who I'm certain you know, and I've been friends for years, in addition to the fact that I spent one summer with the Penobscot Indians. This wasn't in Maine, though. They were in New York at the time. Now, it has been my strong impression for years that the Indians of America do not want to become molded like the white man. And I am certain, I'm almost positive that you feel the same way. However, on these reservations, you have also been aware that when you have spoken with the Indians in these high legal terms, I certainly didn't comprehend what you were saying, even though you were on their side. They knew this for a fact. However, you're well aware of the Indian death rate in this country. And this is horrendous, in my opinion, because whose country was it? I was wondering, is there any possible way for us as human beings to enter these reservations and attempt in some way to bring up their standards so that their death rate will not be such a low scale, because I believe their death rate is 40. And the children die off quickly. They're clean, beautiful, hard-working people that just want to live in the way that they were accustomed to living, and they cannot see themselves migrating into the quote-unquote American way. Now, I realize what you are trying to do, but if they, and they will not get all that land, I'm certain you're well aware, but if they were to get all the land, do you think that they honestly would be accepted as human beings with the white bureaucratic system out here?
Well, let me just say two things in response. I don't see any reason why they shouldn't get all that land. I don't see any reason in the world why they shouldn't. So I disagree with you on that. They said they don't want the land that's occupied. That's 20% of the land they've got a claim to. I don't see any reason in the world why they shouldn't get the rest of it. But that's my own feeling. I see no reason legally, and nor do I see any reason morally why they shouldn't. But, the moral question doesn't really enter into it. As far as the rest of it goes, you know, those are, I really try to be their lawyer, and I don't make judgments about what they are or want to be. I certainly don't define their aspirations for them. To the extent that there are health problems and problems of those sorts, they're linked to being poor. And as I said before, these tribes shouldn't have been poor. Shouldn't have been in a position where they had to beg from anybody. Not only shouldn't it have happened, that should be something that can be changed.
There's a question.
Yes.
How about the lands in the West that were transferred by a treaty, but then the treaties were not ratified by the Senate? Was that land transferred by...
what happened was that the federal government wound up doing it one way or another. It doesn't have to be through a treaty necessarily. You know, there are other ways. Frequently, they just did it by statute. In the West, the tribes the non-recourse act claims by and large just don't exist, and it's a fact. And the political question doctrine is what really drives people. Yes,
what kind of casualty can you give to the right of discovery? Invaders have a gun in one hand, a Bible in the other.
It's a right that's been recognized from the beginning that by virtue of coming with the power to stay and to surround. You don't acquire title to the Indians' land, but you acquire the right that you get by discovery is the right to hold everybody else at bay, to keep all the other potential discoverers away, so that when and if the natives get ready to part with their land, you can get it. And that makes sense to me, that by virtue of discovery, you didn't get any rights vis-a-vis the Indians. The rights that the Europeans claimed by virtue of discovery were between them and the other Europeans, you see. By discovery, it was a way of sorting out between the Europeans who was going to get the right to deal with natives in a particular area. And that seems legitimate enough. Can you understand that?
I understand what you're saying, but from the Indian point of view, I
don't
see
any. Well, no, from the Indian point of view, it's just a question of who's going to be there, of which non-Indian is going to come and talk to them.
I don't understand why the Passamaquoddies and the Wahsatches allow the people to remain on their land.
No, that's their own choice.
Yes, I know it's their choice, but I don't agree with it.
In the West, in the past, they have recognized certain land grants because of the war between the United States and Mexico.
Right.
And in comparison to that, prior to the land grants and prior to the federal government, or today's federal government being involved in that section of the country, there were treaties that were consummated by the King and Queen of England with the tribes in Virginia. Particularly the Rappahannock tribe, the Chickahominies, and the others. These tribes are the ones who do not have state reservations. Since they did recognize some of those Western land grants, is there a possibility, or does the possibility exist, that these old treaties, the Treaty of 1646, 1690, and 1727,
It seems to me, although I don't know the particulars of the situation you're talking about, that at the time the tribes probably did have lands reserved to them through these grants that were recognized by treaties. The question is, what happened subsequently? How were those lands lost?
Mostly through trickery, taken away from them.
The problem is when. If it happened before the Non-Intercourse Act in 1790, which I think is when most of the transactions took place, then you can have troubles. But I'd rather discuss the details of that outside of the fellow forum. Yes.
This, I know, is speculation, probably, but I'm asking, what is a reasonable timetable on the resolution of this thing, either through following the legal course to its end or getting close enough so that serious negotiation can take place?
Well, the legal course will take 5 to 10 or 15 years. For the rest of it, that's all right. We've been at it for a long time now. What's another 5 or 10 years? Judge Gunter has said that he wants to make a recommendation to the president by June 15th. The Justice Department has said they're going to proceed with the actions by June 1, unless there's a negotiated settlement. The statute of limitations is coming up on July 18, and so any additional claims that are going to get filed on behalf of Maine, and very little of the case has actually been filed already, will have to be filed before July 18. So we have some real practical time limitations coming up. It's very difficult for me to say what's a realistic time frame. I do think that the President is trying, is sincerely trying to deal with this issue.
Two issues about Maine come to me on this case. One is I know that a lot of the land in Maine is owned by out-of-state corporations, and how have they figured in this? And the other is I wonder if any of the lands in question are coastline, because that has a lot more value.
Yeah, a lot of land is coastline, although most of that's occupied. And yes, most of the paper companies are foreign. I mean, Maine essentially is a colonial state. In the sense that it's not local. Yes.
You said that about 90% of the negotiations between Indians and the U.S. government are legal.
99% for the land in the United States.
But what I'm wondering is, like, that's all according to the U.S. legal system, you know? Like the, a lot of the acts that were passed were passed like pretty much just by the U.S. government, you know, and
right.
How much did of a role did the Indians ever have in any of those?
Not acts? Much.
So something like the Non-Intercourse Act, did the Indians have any say in even producing, like, you know, like all of these laws are U.S. laws, so it's really not recognizing Indians as nations at all, and
well,
that's a big contradiction in my mind about this.
It's not that simple, because the United States does afford tribes a measure of sovereignty, and it does recognize a measure of sovereignty, and it's a question that's just too complicated to get into now. You're right, it's harsh that most, you know, that so few of the tribes have an opportunity to challenge what was done, but that's the law.
To me, what does that sovereignty mean? Will that mean that there'd be a separate country like Quebec wants to be?
It's really, I've got to end up the whole thing now, and that's another 2 hours. I'd love to stay and talk to you about it, but it's too complex.
It won't be separated then from the Union?
No, that much I can say. Yes.
There's a strong land trust movement in New England. I wondered if there have been contact with the land trust people in the statewide or other levels.
They've been very supportive. We simply haven't had time to deal with them in the way we want to. In fact, I feel very badly that I haven't had time to spend any more time with them than I have. They've been, I can say, they've been very supportive of the tribes and their claims.
So that's the real concept of, you know, of the value of the land being held in trust.
Right. Well, folks, that was nice.
Complicated for the governors to come to our meeting tonight. So maybe after they get all that land back, they'll come back and visit us. On behalf of the Board of Directors, welcome again to the 95th Annual Meeting of the Indian Rights Association. And we have with us tonight from welcome to members and friends, and we have with us tonight from the Board of Directors, Mr. John Cadwalader, the Vice President, Theodore Hetzel, General Secretary, Morris Davis Forth, Treasurer, Dr. Daniel Blaine, Sandra Cadwalader Esquire, John Edwards, L. Eldon Lindsay, Jr., Ed Nakawatasi, Joseph Oxendine, Lundy, Jonathan Steer, Mr. Worcester, voting his regret. And we have with us tonight board members Meredith, Leo T. Connor, and Marcy Lindley. Also present is Miss Elaine Riviere, our new administrative secretary and editor of Indian Truth. Also, Mrs. Merrill. Elaine, you stand so we're going to see you. And also, Mrs. Marilee Richards, who is part-time staff in the Community Rights Association office. The Indian Rights Association this past year under the leadership of Dr. Blaine urged passage of the Indian Health Care Improvement Act, and with Dr. Blaine's initiative were effective in obtaining the endorsement of that act by the American Psychiatric Association, which has an effective lobby. Under Dr. Blaine's direction, the association approved a grant.
I'm thinking for the nominating committee, I would place the following names on the slate for officers. Betty Krause Mealy as president, John Cadwalader, vice president, Theodore B. Hetzel, general secretary, E. Morris Davis IV, treasurer, and as board members, Ann H. Balk, Sandra L. Cadwalader, John R. Edwards, Jean Hansen Fisher, David B. Fitzgerald, Esquire, L. Eldon Lindley, Jr., Ed Nakawatasi, Joseph Oxendine, Charles E. Pancoast III, Suzanne Corral Ponce, Sandra Lakota Spaulding, Jonathan M. Steer, Jr., Thomas Worcester, Jr., and Emeritus Board members Leo T. Connor, Esquire, and Lawrence E. Lindley.
Excuse me, there is one name that's submitted in error of the letterhead is printed. Dr. Daniel Blaine has written that.
I apologize for this, but in addition, Dr. Daniel Blaine, as president.
I move the nomination.
Second.
As many are in favor of the proposed slate, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. The ayes have it.
Ready?
Yes.
Minor. What's unfinished business? I move that the minutes be approved as the treasurer's report be revised.
Second or
second?
Second.
Are there any corrections?
I move the
second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstention? Yeah, if there is no further business, this meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
Yeah. I talked to you.